For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
1 week later, they have voted to expel one of the three, voting pretty much on party lines, about 72 to 25. They have the two-thirds majority. It's likely they're going to do the same thing to the other two. Many voices in that House argued for moderation, saying expulsion for a rules violation was simply too extreme. They called it a nuclear option. But basically, the argument was made by the Speaker that this was a mutiny, that this was dishonor, that this was an insurrection. So one Democrat is out. It's likely two more will be out by the end of the night.
There's this was not the clip that I pressed.
That's okay. That's all right.
This is not the clip that I pressed. I don't know what happened.
It was also a big top news story of the day. And in fact, you know, we can make that work, Katie, because the subject matter was the school shooting in Nashville, Tennessee, involving a Christian school. And there's a lot of issues that came out of that shooting on many different sides of the aisle. And we're going to speak with Daryl Jones next, who is the president at the Herzog Foundation, about that topic and so many others in and around school choice. Daryl joins us once again here on the Tim Jones and Chris Sarp Show. Daryl Jones, thanks for joining us once again here today.
Friends, it is great to be with my St. Louis buddies. How are you on the other side of the state today?
Fantastic.
We are doing just fine. Daryl Jones, of course, the president of the Herzog Foundation, herzogfoundation.com. Dr. Jones, I'm sure that the school shooting in Nashville was a sobering thing for all of us, but as an organization that prides itself on putting forth the best Christian schools in the Show Me State, I mean, that had to be something that kind of took you all back and made you think about everything that you all do on a daily basis.
You know, it was certainly a wake-up call, I would say, for Christians and Christian schools and churches across the country. I mean, you know, for the last several years, The Lion, readlion.com, we've written a number of stories last year just about violence that was directed towards Christians and Christian values, whether it was churches or crisis pregnancy centers. What's been interesting is to see now there really is an attack on our children. And it's just very sobering and very disheartening. You know, I've said before that, you know, Jesus had a cross on his back. We recognize that even this weekend. And Christians through the ages have certainly been swimming upstream or certainly touting the values of a bigger kingdom. And we just, you know, we see in our day that, you know, there's a lot of hate and evil in the world. And that's, you know, the Christians need to not cower. It's interesting to me, historically, the martyrs of the Christian faith didn't have a death wish. They just weren't afraid to die. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think what we're seeing in our day is just the need for Christians to stand and to be who they are and recognize that they won't necessarily be loved for it.
Daryl, first off, I want to wish you a early happy Good Friday and Easter. You know, I was looking, I was at home and I was looking at my Alexa with the device, which gives me headlines, and it talked about in Oklahoma is going to have the first Christian charter school soon. Can you tell us more about that?
You know what, that is an interesting topic that we have certainly looked at. Some of the challenges there, and I'll be anxious to see how they actually navigate it. Oftentimes when it is state dollars with charter schools that are funding it, there are oftentimes a lot of strings that can be attached that make it difficult to actually play out and be extremely Christian. Now, having said that, there are a number of values that are certainly Christian that can be fulfilled, and a number of charter schools, certainly classical charter schools, are able to be very true to, you know, to Christian values while not necessarily being a Christian school per se.
Speaking to Daryl Jones, the president of the Herzog Foundation, herzogfoundation.com. You should also check out their publication at readlion.com. It's free for all. readlion.com. You know, Daryl, as Christians start heading back to the churches beginning tonight for many Holy Thursday services, Good Friday services, Easter, folks who maybe only go to church a couple times a year, Christers, as sure. My wife and daughters right. call them, the Christmas and Easter Catholics and Christians. You know, some people may be thinking, you know, maybe there's something here for my children. You know, I like yeah. what I'm hearing here. I like what I'm hearing about the institution of the sacraments and this fellow Jesus Christ who yeah. died for all of us, and love your neighbor as yourself. There's so much weirdness right. going on in our public school system. Right. Why are Christian schools so important in this day and age with all of this noise around us?
Oh, my goodness. What a great question, Tim. I appreciate you asking. You know, the reality is, just in general, Christian values are so needed at a time. I was a youth minister for 11 years and worked with teenagers on a regular basis, full time. And I will tell you, there is such a loss of passion among people today. There's just a heartlessness. There's no purpose. There's no meaning. There's not enough dollars to give me a reason or a purpose. And that's what Jesus came to do, was to bring value to who you are, for who you are, that you are made in the image of God, and that he loves you just the way you are. And he could have made you any way he wanted, and he did. And that's lost in our culture. And if there was ever a time for churches to speak out about new life, and for Christian schools to rise up, and for Christians just to live out the Christian life, oh my goodness, our culture would gain so much in that kind of transformation.
You know, Daryl, leftists call us conspiracy theorists when we say that they subscribe to a philosophy, a Marxist philosophy, where your kids belong to the state. And we're starting to see that more and more. We see teachers telling kids that we are teaching this particular philosophy, but don't tell your kids. We'll call you your alternate pronouns here at school, but don't tell your parents that we're allowing you to do that. I mean, all the conspiracy theory that we've heard over the years, Daryl, it's coming true.
Oh my goodness. Lincoln said it second. Jesus said it first. A house divided against itself can't stand. And we have got a whole culture, and certainly a system, an education system, that really is polarized in terms of us versus them, when of all entities it comes to, you know, the educators versus the parents. It's an interesting day that we're living in, and you know, as we've discussed before, it's interesting to see across the country where parents are becoming frustrated with the system and are actually rising up. And now, you know, across the country, legislators are paying attention and creating options where, I mean, honestly, you know, Tim, you were in the House. Mm-hmm. I never dreamed in my lifetime that we would see the state of Missouri with some kind of an education savings account for private education. And yet that's the day that we're living in, because of really just a pretty much a statewide, which is a microcosm of a nationwide gag reflex, where parents are saying enough is enough. We want our kids back. Mm-hmm. These are our kids. And that battle is, those lines are just being drawn more clearly in this day. It's an interesting day.
And Daryl, let's talk about how important those changes in public policy are, and how important this movement is. You know, I hear a lot of people, Daryl, on both sides of the aisle say, well, you know, if we just had more local control of public school districts, then the problem would be solved. Well, Daryl, we already have elections in public school districts, mm-hmm. and there's 522 mm-hmm. districts across the state. Unfortunately, a ton of them, dozens and dozens and maybe hundreds of them, even though they have local control, they're not doing what's in the best interest of the child because the parents are saying that. Winsome Sears, right. Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, this last week went on Bill Maher's show, and she said, I don't co-parent with anyone other than my husband, you know? I don't co-parent with the school board. I don't co-parent with the education establishment. I don't co-parent with the unions. That's the point of having educational options, isn't it?
Absolutely. When you look at the very earliest stages in America of public education, I mean, there was a day where, you know, where parents were raising their children to help with the farm, to help with the ranch. And then the ranch or the farm became too big. And they said, listen, Laura Ingalls, we'll pay you. Go to the church, the one room church, and you teach our kids. And then even as public education began to grow, it was growing within values, within a community where the person that was, you know, teaching the students shared the values of the parents and of the community and saw that they were being hired by the parents to help fulfill this vision. What's interesting today is just this idea that, no, we are the stewards of the children, not the parents. The parents can't be trusted. We know better than parents what children need, and it's a bold statement for sure.
Daryl, we had a representative on a few weeks ago. You weren't able to be on, I think. Talked about your program called School Box, which is entrepreneurship and Christian education. That really intrigues me. Can you talk more about that?
Listen, School Box is our latest initiative, and we're very excited about it. It's an online platform for the sole purpose of helping churches or neighborhoods or small groups of people to say, hey, we want a Christian school in our community. It's state specific. You know, all education laws are state specific. So it's state specific for all 50 states, but it provides the roadmap for the 8 necessary steps that every school launch group needs to think through in order to create a Christian school. Everything from the legal structure and the 501c3 to where you're going to house this. Are you going to do it in a one-room schoolhouse? I mean, that's very popular in 2023. That's what's exploding in Arizona are these micro schools, these one-room schoolhouses with a dozen kids of varying ages. The curriculum becomes essential there. The teacher becomes much more of a facilitator. But there are a number of entrepreneurial education opportunities, hybrid schools, that are just really exploding across the country. And we think our secret sauce to School Box is not simply providing the free online roadmap, HF Herzog Foundation, hfschoolbox.com, not simply providing the roadmap that's state specific, but once a launch group tells us, hey, here's the kind of school that we want to create, then we at the foundation, through our network of educators across the country, will identify a head of school who's actually leading that exact kind of Christian school, and we'll pay that head of school to coach your launch group online via a Zoom call through each one of the necessary steps for a successful launch. And there's no charge for any of that. That is our mission, to serve as a catalyst to advance K-12 Christian education. So we're very excited about School Box. To be honest with you, we rolled it out nationwide 3 weeks ago, and right now we have 52 schools in School Box with a mentor preparing to launch in the fall of 2023. We have another 25 preparing for the fall of 2024, and we've got a half dozen that are really wanting to make sure they dot their I's and cross their T's and are preparing for 2025. So fantastic. We're very excited about this new initiative that we really think is going to be a resource for churches and for neighborhoods and for concerned parents to take back the education of their kids.
Wonderful. Wow. Not just pointing out problems, but providing solutions. That's what the good folks at the Herzog Foundation are doing. Folks, if you need any more information about any of this discussion we've had here today, if you're at your wit's end with your public school, then simply go to herzogfoundation.com. Help can be on its way. Daryl, thanks so much for joining Chris and I once again here today.
Thank you, Daryl.
Listen, it is always a pleasure to be with you. God bless you guys and have a great holiday weekend.
You too, sir.
You too as well. HerzogFoundation.com, ReedLion.com. Man, Chris, there's an organization on the move.
They are doing it, working with 52 new schools, that school box program, blending in entrepreneurship with education. Entrepreneurship, you can't go wrong.
Mm-mm.
And our school system needs to be revamped dramatically, so do it.
One of the biggest things that the public school system has not have, that the Herzog Foundation is challenging them on, is competition, right? Competition to make everybody stronger, including your local public school. All right, that was a great discussion. If you just tuned in, you missed any of that, we podcast everything. NewstalkSTL.com, NewstalkSTL.com. Everything is available there. We'll be back here with Dakota Wood. What a perfect day to have Dakota Wood on with the unveiling of that insane report that Tony and Katie were talking about earlier about the after-action report relating to the Afghanistan evacuation. We'll discuss that and likely so many more topics with Dakota Wood when Chris and I return here on the
channel. You know, wait, before you do that, yes, I know what it is. I can sum it up in two words.
Yes, yes.
Like, Trump's fault.
Trump's fault.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll see. You know what? We'll ask Dakota that and see if he agrees or disagrees. And I bet you the conversation will continue further. Great point, Chris. We'll be back with Dakota Wood next here at 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewstalkSTL.com.
I would refer you to the ODNI if you have specific questions on their reporting. What I can tell you from here and what we have said many times is that we knew the flight path of the balloon before it crossed the United States. We took precautions in advance to ensure that it didn't get sensitive information. And when it comes to technology like this balloon, it has limited additive value compared to other means of intelligent collection. And we have said that. And the bottom line is this is the administration that identified the problem and took action.
Hey. Welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Sarp Show, 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL. I know we have about an hour and a half of questions for our next guest. We're going to try to get him in about 15 minutes. He is Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota, good afternoon.
How are you, sir?
Hey, did you guys just play cricket sounds?
We did.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, that's good old producer Katie over here, Dakota. I mean, Dakota, what else do you say? You kind of, you know, it's like that meme, you know, where the guy looks at him kind of half sideways, cockeyed, because it's like, did you really just say that? Because Dakota, when the balloon was flying over the country, meandering, oh, I don't know, accidentally over every single military installation in the United States of America, including several here in Missouri, Dakota, they told us there was no problem. There's nothing to see here. We know for a fact it's not gathering intelligence. And now, Dakota, we know it was exactly doing what most Americans thought it was doing. Americans aren't stupid, Dakota, but this administration thinks we are.
Well, okay, so here's a meme for you guys. You can dig it up. You guys are so skilled at this. Back in 1991, during a Desert Storm, do you remember the Iraqi spokesperson?
Yes, Baghdad Bob.
About Iraqi forces winning Baghdad Bob, right?
Yes.
Meanwhile, there was split screen on the television showing American tanks in downtown Baghdad, right? So the spokesperson's comments were so divorced from the reality that everybody else saw that it just became a joke, right? And so here we have the Biden White House saying, hey, it's all under control. We knew exactly what this balloon package, you know, was doing, and we covered all of its tracks and didn't get anything. It's just an absolute fiction, right? That spies and surveillance capabilities utilize all sorts of different things, from satellites to human intelligence, electronic eavesdropping, cyber intrusions, all this stuff, to scoop up as much as they possibly can. So to think that this balloon is going to hover over Whiteman Air Force Base or other installations, change direction so it can, you know, prolong its duration,
right,
and they weren't able to collect anything. I mean, it's just a lie. To take all the reporting about the debacle of our exit from Afghanistan and at every incident say it's all Trump's fault, right? It's just a complete fiction. To say that our southern border is absolutely secure, there's no problems, ignore all the fentanyl pouring in and the human trafficking and all those, you know, child abuse, etc. It's just a fiction. So I just don't understand how the Biden administration can continue to propagate these falsehoods, right, that are demonstrably proven false, in contradiction to everybody in their awareness from news media and social media as to what's going on in the real world. I mean, it's a Baghdad Bob moment all over again.
Dakota, Finland was admitted to NATO this week, and that extended greatly our border, NATO's border with Russia. Sweden, their next door neighbor, is trying to get into NATO, but there are two countries that are holding them up. I think one is Turkey. I forgot the other. Why is that?
Hungary, I think. Yeah, well, Turkey has a big problem because there are actors in Turkey, part of the Turkish Kurdish population, that Turkey views as terrorists. And some of those folks have gone up into Sweden to seek refuge, political sanctuary up there. And Turkey wants Sweden to be more declarative in viewing these people the same way that Turkey does and taking steps to either send them back to Turkey or to imprison them in some way or what have you. So it's like they've put a hold on Sweden's accession into NATO, just like a senator in the U.S. Senate will put a hold on nominations until an administration, you know, comes around to whatever the senator is wanting the administration to do. So that's the biggest one. Hungary, I'm not really sure what Viktor Orban's issue is with Sweden. It's not going to hurt Hungary's, interests or, their expenses. I think it has more to do with things that the European Union is supposed to be providing to Hungary in terms of monies that are supposed to flow. The EU is holding those things. Hungary is not getting them. NATO is a different organization, but almost all NATO countries are part of the European Union. So I think it might be a convoluted way of pressuring NATO countries who are also part of the European Union to force the EU's hands to free up funds going into into Hungary. So I think that's where the complexity comes. Sweden will eventually get in. Finland's joining up is a huge, huge win. They have a remarkably capable military. They held the Soviet Union off throughout the Cold War. Even though they weren't able to join NATO, that was kind of the deal. The Soviets knew not to move into there. Over 800 miles of border with Russia today, and Russia now will have to take into account this new energized, militarized northern part of Europe and not devote all of itself into either Ukraine or Syria, or even putting up as some kind of a defense in the Far East against China. So it's a huge win for NATO, and Vladimir Putin did not want to see this occur, but his assault of Ukraine is really what sowed the seeds of this.
Speaking to Dakota Wood, an expert on all things international foreign policy and defense-oriented from the Heritage Foundation. Dakota, let's talk about, you made reference to the after-action report, the summary of what happened. According to the Biden administration, that it is making available to Congress and the rest of our U.S. government. Mm-hmm. Dakota, from what, I haven't had a chance to read the report from the quick dissection I've heard from our station and others, that it came out earlier this afternoon. Dakota, I've gotten two trains of thought that the Biden administration has said about it. So on one hand, they've said everything went swimmingly well and they're just so happy about everything they learned from it. But on the other hand, they're saying, but if anybody doesn't like anything about the Afghanistan withdrawal, it's all Trump's fault. I mean, those two things, as usual, with the Biden administration can't be true at once, can they?
No, they can't. And what went swimmingly well is if there was any military force on the planet that could have taken as many people as were taken out of Afghanistan, what, 120,000 or more, with no loss of civilian life in the transport out, I mean, Abbey Gate aside from that, mm-hmm. but in that kind of a cauldron, the U.S. Air Force and the supporting military services are the only ones that could have done that. So it's an extraordinary feat that they should never have been called upon to do, right? So all the decisions that led up to it, the death of that poor aid worker and 9 or 10 or other of his families, with the drone strike that came after, the suicide bombing at Abbey Gate, people falling off of the wheels of C-17 transports that are taking off from Kabul International, the fact that Americans were left behind, that if anybody wanted to get out, they had to go through Taliban checkpoints at severe risk to their own lives and livelihood to even get to the airfield. They're on the south side of Kabul, all of that controlled by the Taliban. There's no way that you can say that this was a strategic win. And a lot of analysts that I really respect in their research and writing say that debacle in Afghanistan really set the stage for Russia thinking that, yeah, we can go into Ukraine because the U.S. is feckless. They don't have any competency in foreign policy and in the execution of military affairs, evidenced by what occurred in Afghanistan. And then on the other part with blaming Trump, if I recall, within the first week or two, when the Biden administration came in, they overturned just about everything that President Trump had put into place, you know, like securing the border, right? Border wall gone, the outreach to Iran, how we were dealing with China. So how is it that they had freedom to overturn everything that Donald Trump did during his presidency, but somehow Trump's agreement with the Taliban, right, and a long-term conditions-based withdrawal from Afghanistan tied the Biden administration hands, and there's no way that they could overturn that, right? You know, that they were bounded by the actions of the previous administration when no other policy decision by the previous administration bound Biden's hands in any other policy area. I mean, how do you make sense of that?
Dakota, speaking of China, it seemed a few years ago that the Philippines were becoming less of a U.S. ally and becoming closer to China. I think they closed down a base or didn't renew a base on the island. Now we're seeing that recently we just signed a new deal with the Philippines where we're going to have four new bases there. What has happened over the intervening 4 or 5 years?
We used to have Clark Air Base and Subic Bay Naval Station, which were the largest installations of their type in the world. U.S. used them all the time. I sailed in and out of there on Navy ships, even as a young midshipman out of the Naval Academy. It was just a fantastic place. Then you had Mount Pinatubo, this big volcanic structure in the Philippines that erupted, and it coated all those facilities with all kinds of ash, caused all kinds of destruction. And at that time, Cold War is receding. We were on the outs politically between the U.S. government and the Philippine government, and it just wasn't thought to be monetarily worthwhile to reinvest to fix those facilities and try to force a presence. So we all kind of went our separate ways. The Philippines thought they could get a lot of love out of China. Clearly, China is nobody's best friend. Meanwhile, you've seen the rise of some insurgencies, some communist-backed insurgencies, in some of the outlying islands that comprise the Philippines. You know, it's a huge archipelagic mixture of various islands and atolls. So we then go to today, and the leadership in the Philippines says China's becoming much more militarized. They're pushing our fishing vessels out of disputed waters. They're militarizing islands to deny us access, you know, air and sea. They're really, really posing a threat. You know, those American guys, they weren't bad partners. And so getting them back into the Philippines is a kind of a security measure, you know, a hedge against China, able to share intelligence information and continue the military support to the Philippine military, which helps them better take care of their insurgent problem. So I think it's a win-win for both sides. It gives us better posture in the Indo-Pacific, puts China on notice, and the Philippines comes out as a big winner.
Dakota, we could speak with you for another hour and a half or so, probably, but we got to let you go for now. We'll leave the conversation right there, pick it up next week. Dakota, I know we all want to wish you a very happy and joyful Easter weekend, and thanks for joining us here on Holy Thursday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless, guys.
Thank you for not frightening us to death on Easter weekend. Thank you, sir.
It's a good news Thursday.
Exactly. Thank you, Dakota Wood.
Take care, friends.
Thank you. With the Heritage Foundation. What a great guy. I mean, my goodness. Oh, yeah. We always learn so much.
He's a St. Louisan.
Yes, he is. He's been through here. Mm-hmm. He's been through here during his lifetime. We need to take a break now. 4:42. My goodness, already 4:42 in the p.m. I think Chris's Corner is up
next. Yeah, Chris's Corner is the dangers of consuming one-sided media.
Ooh, very good.
Very nice.
Yes.
Very well done. That'll be next here on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show, 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
I mean, it's clear that the Republican Party is the party of dinosaurs, right? 1897. It's clear that they don't have any proposals. They don't have a platform right now. It's just grievance politics. It's just scaring people. What I worry about is they still want power. And when you still want power, the only way to get it when you don't have a platform is by cheating. And so that's right. When you see the gerrymandering. That's when you see people on college campuses being prevented from using their college ID to vote.
That's when you see ballot harvesting. That's when you see. Oh, she forgot those. Yeah, she forgot those.
I was just going to say, Chris, there's an example of that one-sided media I know you're going to talk about. If you can consider The View media, the sad thing is, as Katie often tells us, a lot of people do get their daily news dose from places like The View.
They do. They do. And, you know, Chris's Corner, as I said, the title is The Dangers of Consuming One-Sided Media.
Chris.
The whole thing is a joke.
Good God, we gotta do something here, people.
It's not personal, it's strictly business.
My favorite black leader of all time is Frederick Douglass, who asked after emancipation, well, we just freed the blacks, now what are we gonna do? And his answer was, leave us alone.
And if you don't know, now you know.
And now, Chris's Corner.
You know, the Wall Street Journal today had an article that gave credence to my theory that the Democrats actually do want Donald Trump to be their nominee, and that, you know, could be the reason for this indictment that you see. Part of the, I'm reading a quote. The quote from the article, the Wall Street Journal article, was this, quote, "I think generally Democrats are relishing the idea of a rematch with Trump because it's such a clear contrast," said Matthew Munsey, the chair of the Northampton County Democratic Committee in Pennsylvania. "Everything Trump has done since we beat him has been the opposite of demonstrating presidential qualities. Some Democrats said they did worry that Mr. DeSantis might be tougher to take on, even as they expressed confidence in Mr. Biden." I looked out of breath here, sorry. "Back on April 1st, I wrote this 5 days prior, and I actually said this beforehand. I wrote on my Facebook page, I've been a political operative for close to 25 years, and I'm not buying in the least that Alvin Bragg is just a rogue prosecutor prosecuting Donald Trump because he hates him and wants to destroy him. Yes, Bragg and the Democrats are interfering in an election with this indictment, but is not for the reasons cited by my fellow Republicans and conservatives. The Democrats do not fear Donald Trump. The Democrat establishment has said many, many times that Trump is the only candidate they feel they can beat in 2024. Why do I say that? Because Biden has done it before, they say. The Democrat establishment brought this case against Trump, the weakest of the three pending criminal investigations against Trump, because they know it will inflame his supporters and those on the fence to his side, and they are hoping this will propel him to the Republican nomination. It also helps that the prosecutor is black, which could stave off criticism of this being just a political indictment. Make no doubt about it, Democrats want Trump as the Republican nominee, and this indictment is part of their plan to make sure that that happens." Sorry. I went to the restroom
first. Take a breath. Yeah, you're good.
I'm no sage on this. I'm not saying I'm some political sage. But the Democrats have been telegraphing this for months on their Sunday shows, on CNN, MSNBC opinion shows, the left-wing print media, on their blogs. You know, people accuse me of being a rhino because I'm giving the political analysis that they are telling us. Just because I'm giving their strategy doesn't mean I agree with it. I'm giving political analysis. You know, to give good political analysis, you have to understand your enemy. Su Tseng, the Chinese warrior, said, "If you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear 100 battles. You have to know your enemy. The best way to do that is to read and watch their programs." You know, there's one of my favorite movies is the General Patton movie. It came out in 1970. George C. Scott won an Academy Award for that role. The movie won Best Actor. And there's a famous scene after he started beating Rommel, the German general, very badly. He started retreating, and this is what General Patton said to George C. Scott.
Rommel, you magnificent bastard, I read your book!
And that's what he said. He read his book. He knew his enemy. He knew his strategy. I've said several times here, after President Trump was elected, I wanted to know who this man was. I told Becky, order me, please, a copy of The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump, because that will figure out to me how he thinks and everything. And once I read that book and I saw some of the things he did in the early parts of his presidency, some of the strategy, some of the negotiating tactics, I said, yeah, I understand him. Because I've read his book. So my point is, look, it's fine to watch Newsmax and Fox and OANN and only watch and listen to conservative radio. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you want to learn what the other side is thinking and be able to cut them off in the past before they want to install that stuff, you have to listen to alternative, watch alternative news media. Now, for me, I'm a political junkie. Even though I don't agree with any of the things on MSNBC, I find political talk exciting. I find it interesting, and it gives me, as I said, an insight, a strategy to the other side's thinking. But, you know, again, I want to reiterate this because I get this all the time. And when you give some type of political analysis, because this is how I view it from what the Democrats are saying, that the people confuse that with, this is your thoughts, this is what you believe. No, it's not necessarily that at all. You know, I have not chosen a dog or in this presidential race. So because I'm saying that the Democrats want Donald Trump to be the nominee, not saying that because I hate Donald Trump and don't want him to be president. I've always said that this is going to put him in a very strong position. And my only concern, and if Donald Trump was a nominee, I'd vote for him again. I voted for him twice before. I'd vote for him again. My one concern, and I've said this many, many times, is I am worried and concerned are those voters that voted for him in 2016 who basically hated Hillary and said, I will take a chance on Donald Trump and vote for him. Vote for Trump. Can he gain those voters back in 2024? And that's going to be the big question. And that is Chris's Corner.
I think it's a fair
question. Boy, I will never go down to the restroom and run winded. Back and try to do Chris's all Corner right. ever again.
We're doing wind sprints now. Woo! I think all of us. I think all of us could use a few wind sprints because I have two sets of stairs in our house because we have the finished lower level, so I'm always up and down every day. And I'm like, crap, I'm getting older because the stairs are getting...
Stairs can kill you.
The stairs are getting suckier.
Did I sound out of breath?
Yeah,
I did.
You know what? A touch.
So, yeah, I think people are starting to come to that realization that Democrats are definitely trying to pick their poison. And also, I think they're trying to pick the devil they know versus the devil they don't, right? Okay. One time, the Democrats got beat by Donald Trump. One time, they learned, well, if you presume that the election was fairly and adjudicated, which I still think there was plenty of problems. And you know what? They admitted the other night, they did. The other night on CNN, there was this commentator who was talking about, so they were like, they didn't talk about the indictment because there's nothing to talk about. They were like, yeah, Donald Trump's probably right about the indictment. This case that Alvin Bragg's bringing sucks. But we hate Donald Trump because all he did tonight was give this grievance. That's the big word of the week. The grievances of Donald Trump. The grievance industry. You heard Sonny Hostin just parrot that. But one of the things that the commentator was talking about, he was like, and he goes on and on about the 2020 election. And this commentator, he literally said this. He goes, you know, there may have been some instances of, you know, some small amounts of fraud here and there, but there was no, and I was like, wait a minute. Stop the tape, back that up. So you're telling me a little bit of fraud in elections is okay? Yeah. So anyway, they if you believe the election was fairly conducted, and me included, I don't, but if you believe that, they beat him the second time. So they know Donald Trump. They don't know how Ron DeSantis, Mike Pompeo, Nikki Haley, they don't know how those people would run a presidential campaign because they've never run for president before.
Yeah. I agree. When you were out, Tim, we had Greg Keller, of course, our mutual friend. I agree with his position, where he said that there were some irregularities in the election. They were election laws that were changed that were supposed to have been by the legislature, but it was done locally. A lot of shenanigans. The question is, was any of that enough to change the election? That's where a lot of people are saying they haven't seen evidence that it was enough of that to change election.
I believe in Pennsylvania and Georgia, absolutely yes. Pennsylvania upended its election laws 2 weeks before. Georgia sent absentee ballots to every single name on their rolls, whether they were alive or dead, and they required no ballot verification, no signature verification. So I think you could argue just those two states alone. But anyway, let's say it was fine. So back to the original question, Donald Trump. That's the devil they know. The problem is, Chris, they may be being too cute by half, right? Because Bill Maher, who hates Donald Trump, said on his show this week, I think Democrats are playing with fire if they indict him. I think they will absolutely help him in the primary, and they may be helping him enough that he can win the general.
Democrats are going to gin up the abortion issue in 2024, especially after the leftists have taken over the Wisconsin legislature. They think that's an issue for them. We'll have to see. It's going to be exciting.
It will be. You know, John McCain, Mitt Romney didn't win either. I'd take a Donald Trump fighter over any of those two, but we'll see who makes a run. Especially Ron DeSantis, the biggest question mark of them all. Lots more to get to in the 5 o'clock hour, including the speaker's stump speech and Ambassador Francis Rooney, 101.9 941 News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.